Our next guest, Jose Arce, is a local tattoo artist and Tijuana legend. After being deported, he came to the city and turned his dreams into reality by starting off a business and currently promotes the deported lifestyle online through his various social media platforms. Please welcome our guest, Jose Arce. Thank you for coming and speaking to us today. You're local, of course, which is one of the rare cases of that. Most of the people kind of fly out and visit us for a moment, but you're a local here in Tijuana. Can you introduce yourself to our audience?
My name's Jose Arce. I'm better known as Spanky, and I'm a tattoo artist here. I have several other businesses, but my main thing is a tattoo artist.
A tattoo artist in Tijuana Tijuana is known for a lot of things. The rowdy nature. Tijuana was featured in The Simpsons. You know, the famous Simpsons episode where the whole school bus escaped to Tijuana. It's a whole thing. Military members coming over the border, despite they have orders not to. People showing up here for debauchery and getting lost. That's kind of like the vision that a lot of people have about this, about Tijuana, my hometown, by the way. So you've set up a very successful business for yourself here in Tijuana, tattooing people, bringing art to life and on skin, and basically being, you know, a very important member of the tattoo and body modification community here. But you're not from here, though.
No, I'm originally from Jalisco, but I grew up in the States.
You're born in Jalisco. Parents are Mexican, and right. Like many families, they look north for opportunity.
Yeah.
Now, how old were you when that decision was made?
I was 3 years old.
3 years. You don't remember life in Jalisco at all?
I remember life in Jalisco, but not from when I was that age. I went back as a teenager. I went back. I was when I was like 11, 12.
So you make the trip at three. You're in your mom's arms basically.
Right.
So what was their trek up there? Like how did they get across?
I think that back then they ran through. Right here through the border. As a matter of fact, every time I drive through there, I remember that, and I have very, very, very vague memories of that. But I remember walking through the river. I remember my mom walking through
the Tijuana River.
The Tijuana River.
This is what is it? What year is this?
This is like, oh fuck, I mean,
70s.
Like 70s.
This is 70s. Like, so there's no real border fence back then.
No.
There's chicken wire, I think.
Right.
And maybe some of the steel slats and the river was wide open.
I remember there was immigration officers on horses too. I remember that. So
yeah.
it was way back then. I mean, and I, like I said, I have very vague memories of it, but it's like glimpse of it, you know?
Did your parents kind of like remind you of this whole arduous journey as a way like, hey, we had to cross this
Yes. way? And I think that has a lot to do with why I remember certain things because my mom speaks about it a lot.
Yeah. For people that have no experience with that, was it spoken about as a traumatic event or was it spoken of as an easy time crossing?
It was spoken about as an adventure. It wasn't like a dramatic or something that was a bad thing.
When they would talk about it, like why, like what was the reasoning for coming to the U.S.?
Chasing the American dream, you know, that they thought was there. You know what I mean? And I remember my family always talking about that. Even as I got older, you know, it's like, we're here in the States and we're gonna make a big impact. We're gonna do big things. We're gonna buy a house. So it was like
in their minds, they just wanted to have the opportunity to work. To achieve,
yes,
and that's the aspect of a lot of that, of a lot of us that go across. We want to work, we just want the opportunity to work, and there's not a lot of opportunities on this side. Especially, I don't know what it was for them like back then in Jalisco. I can imagine. So my family left Jalisco as well, but they came to TJ specifically, you know, because there was no work, no opportunities. I mean, my grandfather had 11 kids.
Wow.
So it was a long train ride. Apparently, at some point, I think they got all the way to Mexicali until they got here. Your parents, your three, any siblings?
Yeah, I have a younger brother and an older sister.
So your older sister and you are going through this trek across.
Yeah. My brother was born in the States, so he came in after we were there already.
Cool. Your family arrives in L.A. You know, it's always kind of been a mecca, I guess, or it's a place where we're already Mexicans are already established. So, was there any reason why specifically L.A.? Was there kind of
my uncle and my aunt invited my parents to come over here. Oh, there's a lot of work in the United States. You come and you guys are gonna be well off. Here's the thing about us. It was a little different for us because my mom and my parents didn't have the necessity to go to the States. They were doing okay in Jalisco. It wasn't too bad. They had a small business, like a small supermarket, you would say.
Yeah.
And
Abarrotes.
Abarrotes. So they were doing good. It wasn't like a big necessity. It was just the influence of my family members. Oh, come! It's gonna be much better for you over here and things like that. And for them, I mean, they realized that it wasn't the case. They struggled a lot when we came to the States.
Yeah, I mean, you go. They went from being business owners, having everything kind of settled, to chasing this vague dream, and they arrive, and it's not exactly what they expected.
Exactly, that's exactly what happened.
Yeah. So, how are your parents supporting themselves in LA? What are they doing for work as you're three and you're.
My mother was working at this with some, the Orientals used to have a business in downtown LA where they separate cabbage and lettuce and all these things, and they would chop them up. My mom was doing that, and my dad had always been working in like welding, so he did a lot of welding. So it was a struggle because, like I said, they came in, we didn't have nowhere to stay, so we were staying with my aunt, but then. I don't know, there's a saying that says, después de tres días el muerto apuesta, apesta.
Yeah, after 3 days, you know, visits and the dead stink, you know.
Exactly, so that's what happened. And so they had to leave from there. We ended up staying in hotels, I remember that. Not very much, but I remember, like, the stories behind it. So little by little, they started getting on their feet and, you know, and eventually renting an apartment and... It started going okay, but it never got to the point where...
It wasn't this dream that...
It wasn't this, no.
Buy a house and you're going to be great and it's going to be easy.
No. That came later. I mean, my parents eventually did buy a house, but that came a lot later. It wasn't like nowhere near. I was in junior high when my parents bought a house by then, so... But before that, it was a struggle. I remember that. I mean, I remember my mom picking up pennies and cans and stuff like that. To buy us milk.
Yeah.
And we used to live in a, we moved in a little trailer park home, so it was like a little mobile home. And it was three of us. My brother wasn't born yet, but it was my sister, myself, my mom, and my dad. And it was a small little trailer home, probably the size of this thing right here, you know, this room. So. And my mom picking up pennies and cans and whatever she could to get milk and to buy things that we needed. And we used to go to downtown LA. They used to have these shelter places where they'd give you food. They used to eat powder milk and cereal and things like that. So I remember those things because I was already a little bit older than that.
You're growing up there. Is there a difference between the local kids that were born in the U.S. and, you know, los mojaditos?
Yeah, there was a lot of difference.
Are you being treated differently?
Yeah, definitely. I remember being in school, and people used to make fun of me, like even my compañeros from school make fun of me because my English was very broken. You know, my English wasn't good at all, so it was like ESL. It was ESL all the way in, and I would get clowned for that. I remember that, you know? I remember feeling bad about it, you know, but... I just had to suck it up and aguantar, you know, and that's what I did. And it's funny because those motherfuckers that did that, you know, I caught up to them later on in life when I was a different person.
You remembered.
And I remembered, you know, and it wasn't the situation where I thought that I had forgotten all those things. And when you see something like that and you remember how you used to get bullied or how people used to fuck with you,
yeah,
it turns you into that other motherfucker that you didn't know you had inside. So I did a lot of things, you know, and with them, you know, catching up to them later on in school, you know, when we were older. So it was like, oh, you remember me, motherfucker? You did this, you did that. And then it was on and cracking, you know?
Around what year are you in high school there?
I graduated in 93, so I was
So this is Los Angeles in the late 80s and early 90s.
Mid 80s, I was in junior high school.
And can you, like, what's going on, like, in the street? Like, what does it look like? Or what does it look like around you? Like, what are these schools like? Is it bad around you?
It was bad. There was a lot of racial tensions back then
the enemy? Like, who's the perceived enemy?
With the blacks and the Mexicans and the raza, you know, it was always a going at a situation. So
at school, and even
in the streets. But at school, I remember specific moments in school where black kids, and I remember this very clearly because where I went to school, we were pretty much even, but there was times where there was more blacks than Mexicans, and they would try to take advantage of that and become those bullies and become those people that would press up on you.
So it was just color oppression?
It was a color thing, you know?
Yeah.
And, I mean, there was other things, gangs and stuff like that, but at that moment, I still wasn't involved in any of that.
But are you seeing that in school? Gang feel?
Yeah, I was seeing that. I was definitely seeing that. And I'd see it more in the street. We're in elementary. So in elementary, it wasn't too much of that. But I coming out of elementary, I paid attention to a lot of different things, and I remember seeing all that, you know, in the street and with the blacks hanging out with the blacks and the raza with the raza and my neighbors going at it, like at the little mobile trailer park where we used to live. Outside, there was nothing but raza in that mobile trailer park home, but outside, the blacks were out. So they'd come in there and try to fuck with people there. And it was, I remember it was on and cracking. Even the paisa, the señores, you know, come out and...
Was it physical more than guns?
Yeah, it was more physical back then.
Nobody was pulling out a Draco or a gun.
No.
It was like hands...
It was more like hands-on and let's get it on and that was it, you know?
What is this, Ben Davis? Dickies?
It was more Dickies at that time, Dickies. Ben Davis came in later.
Came in later, yeah. Right? So it's, you know, like with the whole dress code and the art and the style and the music, all that. Where are you getting that? Are you getting that from those paisas, the older guys? Like people that don't understand growing up in a culture like that, that we have to dress to belong. This aspect of dressing to belong. It's like, where are you getting your cues? Are you getting, are the older guys kind of showing you? Or?
Yeah. Yeah. That's usually what happens. And you, it's not really them showing you, but you see it and you're like, I want to be like that. That motherfucker looks easy. He's got it going on. He's doing good.
Who was that for you? Who was that guy?
It was just homies that were hanging out in the street, you know, homies that were hanging out there and, you know, they're drinking and they're kicking it and they're always partying with girls and, you know, and it's like you see them and everybody's around them. Like, hey, what's up?
What are your parents saying about that?
They would stay. You know, I remember them telling me in elementary, like, you got to stay away from all that. You know, I don't want you hanging out with them.
Cholos.
Los cholos, los marihuanos, all that. You know, and I was like, I don't hang out with them. But deep inside of me, it's like the first chance I got, I'd be over there chilling with them and talking to them and shit like that. You know.
Yeah. What was the drug of choice back then? La mota. Weed was everywhere, I get it, but was there anything else like at that time?
I remember just the weed, and I remember, I think it was carga, but I wasn't too sure. I was young, so I didn't pay attention to much of that. That was never really my thing, but I remember it would be smoking weed all the time, yeah. And I knew it was marijuana because my dad was the one that would tell me, Those motherfuckers are smoking weed over there. I could smell this shit over
and,
here.
And back then, it's not like now. It's a California heroin weed that they have now.
Yeah.
Like most of the weed here in Tijuana is smuggled from San Diego, yeah, which is pretty fucking hilarious.
I know it is.
But this is stinky, like a dry rot fucking weed from Mexico, yeah, right? That's what people were smoking back then, the brick weed.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. And I remember that shit was common. You know, everybody was smoking weed. I remember a teacher from school used to smoke fucking weed in elementary, and I knew it was weed because I could smell it coming out of school. After we were leaving school, and I could see the motherfucker smoking weed, and I could smell it, so I knew he was smoking weed. But and I never thought of it that way at that time. Like, it was that much of a bad thing.
Ink around you, tattoos, art. Like, that's pretty fundamental now in your life. But where did you see it the first time?
The first time I saw it, and it's funny because I was looking at the screen right now, and my first inspiration with art was... I was all into fucking watching karate movies, right?
Like, well, like,
that was like my thing.
Martial arts movies.
Martial arts movies, yeah.
Like, well, like what? Like what are you watching?
Like Wu-Tang versus Shaolin and all those, you know,
yeah,
back,
that's the shit.
Back then.
Yeah.
Those shit movies. So yeah, it was like my thing. And I remember drawing those little characters on the poles doing their little, you know,
little positions. Fighting positions, yeah.
With the little long hair. And so I remember drawing that and it... I always liked art. I remember, since I can remember, art was my thing, but I never really, really got into it until, like, those movies, you know, and it just escalated into...
Are you seeing body art out there? Because, again, we were talking about this before we started this conversation, how facial tattoos are now, it's not uncommon anymore.
Right.
Like, you'll go to a gas station and somebody has it on their face, but back then it wasn't that prevalent. So are you seeing any ink on people?
You know what? I actually remember the first time that I actually looked at a tattoo and I paid attention to it. I was already like in the ninth grade. I remember seeing people with tattoos, but it was never really my... I remember one specific person. It was a some vato from a neighborhood over there called Florence. It was the first tattoo I ever seen, and he had a Virgin Mary and
La Virgen de Guadalupe.
La Virgen de Guadalupe.
And like if you remember it now, like was it bluish ink? Like how was it? The quality of it was.
Yeah, it was bluish ink, and I remember the ink being all spread. It was all open.
But it was like, oh, you can put this on your skin.
I was like, damn, that's... And I asked him, like, what you get it done? He was like, no, I got it done in the joint. I guess he had been in the joint. And he was an older cat, you know? And I was like, oh, shit, that shit looks cool. But I never, that was it, you know?
Yeah,
it never really, like, and it didn't bring my attention or anything like that. It didn't spark anything interesting in me to do it or anything.
Yeah.
Not yet, not at that point. But what grabbed my attention was the art itself, you know? It's like, oh, shit, they put that shit on the skin. That's cool. That was it, you know?
What got you into actually, you know, starting to create your own art? Like, what was it? Where were you starting that?
I could say that my biggest influence in that is, I remember going to a ditching party and being at this ditching party.
What's a ditching party for people that are not cool and don't know what the fuck that means?
A ditching party is like when you go to school and then you just decide to ditch with a bunch of people, a bunch of homies, and there's a party going on in somebody's house that their parents aren't home, or even abandoned houses. So this is
you going to school but not going to school, or right, being in school and just fucking
and
ditching.
Leaving during class to go to this party where everybody's hanging out, people are drinking and shit like that, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember being there and looking over this fence, I seen this guy airbrushing. That was the first time that my first experience with art itself, it grabbed my attention a lot with the airbrushing thing. So it's like, fuck, man, that shit looks bad.
So an airbrush, for people that don't know, can you describe what an airbrush is?
Airbrush is like a little air gun, like a little air pistol, where you put ink on or paint, and it you press the trigger and air comes out, but it comes out with paint. So it's like spray paint.
Yeah.
But it's an airbrush paint.
It's precise.
It's precise. Yeah, you can do small details or big or.
So people that don't know, you might see this on the hood of a car.
Right. Or like, yeah. Well, that's one of the biggest things that they do with airbrushing is to put these murals on cars.
But also. Clothing.
On clothing and
like
t-shirts.
Back in the 90s and still to this day, you see it around. It's like people will draw custom art on right. t-shirts or you were saying sneakers.
Sneakers, yeah. And like on tennis shoes.
On tennis shoes. So you're seeing this guy basically take this machine and produce this beautiful art on a wall. Was he working on a wall?
He was working on a piece of tela, like a piece of sheet, like a white sheet. And he was practicing, actually, you know, and he hadn't had it for a long time either, as he told me. So it grabbed my attention, and I asked him, how can I go about getting something like this? And then I just focused myself on getting that. I fucking needed it.
There's this party going on behind you.
But I forgot about that already.
I was drinking out there. Yeah. Las mujeres, all that shit's going on behind you.
Yeah.
But you're focused on this dude with this airbrush.
It grabbed my attention. It had such a big impact on me. So it grabbed my attention so much that I was just so focused with him. Like I said, we became good friends. His name's Hugo Navarro. And we became good friends, and he told me where to go about getting stuff. And it was expensive. You know, I remember getting...
How expensive?
It was like for a setup, it was like... somewhere between $700 and $800, you know, and
that's
and I mean, my parents didn't have that money, but my mom made the sacrifice to get it for me for a Christmas, and then that changed my whole life completely. That threw me on a whole different direction. Even though I had my life where I was active, like a gang member, hanging out with the homies and things like that, that changed my whole life completely, because it threw my focus not just on fucking around, but on art, and it would take 50% of my time was dedicated to my art.
I wanted to take this opportunity to thank each and every one of our Patreon members for their generous support. It's the only way we can bring some of these amazing people behind the microphone and have some of these amazing Midnight of the Soul conversations for you guys. If you're not already a part of the Patreon community, please consider joining us. We have our giant online training catalog for you guys to have access to, as well as some exclusive Sneak Reaper Industries merch drops for you guys at the Dead Drop tier. I would also like to thank the company Sneak Reaper Industries, one of our main supporters and a company that provides some of the most amazing urban wear, survival specific, and cutlery out there. Your support not only makes this show possible, but also support some of the charities that we run, including the Fighter's Kitchen out of Puerto Escondido, where we're supporting some up-and-coming fighters under the tutelage of Eddie Farrell. Thank you for your support, and again, please consider joining us on the Patreon. And now back to the show.
And when you say fucking around your homies, I mean, you're people that don't know this, I mean, if you're not a part of that life there, you're young, you're in this community. You have to be in some of these circles to either be safe, belong, not be fucked with, and survive.
Right. Yeah, that's pretty much how it happens.
I mean, you're in a community where you say there's tensions between others. You know, there's danger there, and it doesn't matter how much you want to keep yourself clean and shit like that. There's no way of staying safe in that environment without being.
It's very difficult. I mean, it can be done, but it's very difficult. And plus, it's like my experience, it wasn't just to fit in or to belong in or to be safe. I liked it. It grabbed my attention. I wanted to be a part of that. Like I said, I would see a guy and be like, fuck, look at that. He's got some badass hyenas with him and, you know, fucking smoking weed. They're cool. And he's got money to spend and shit. He's on the fuck. I want to be like that, you know?
Yeah.
So it kind of pulled you into that. And then plus, when you start getting familiar and you start, you know, hanging out with the homies, and you start realizing that these motherfuckers are like your family. They're cool. You know, it's like, you got somebody. My brother was young. My sister had nothing to do with me. So it's like, I mean, she was on a whole different. This is my hangout. This is where I want to be and kick it at.
So you're doing that is in your life, school's in your life, but art is that's like half of your life, basically. Yeah. what are you drawing? What are your canvases look like? What is it that you're kind of putting into your art?
I have a background with graffiti, so my background came a lot with doing characters and things like that. But I used to like drawing a lot of cartoon characters, and in school, people would want that.
What is it with the Looney Tunes? Was it
Looney Tunes? Yeah, it was a lot of Looney Tunes.
What is it with Looney? Like, I grew up with that whole Cholo, Tasmanian Devil, Bugs Bunny in like Cholo clothing. You know,
right?
What is it with the Looney Tunes? Why the Looney Tunes?
It was popular, and it was. I mean, I liked it. It was fucking popular. People wanted to be a part of that. People wanted to have that. You know. I mean, they will sell T-shirts with those characters, and people would want to buy them. So when we start airbrushing and you start doing some custom work, and especially in the hood, people want to have that shit. You know, you fucking have Tasmanian Devil with some Cortez on and the bandana, and he's got a fucking joint in his mouth. And
now we have AI, and you can just fucking prompt this bullshit. Right. But back then, it was like...
You have to draw it out.
You have to have a dude that knows how to draw it, right. Knows how to put it to life, and knows how to make it look cool. You say you have you had a graffiti inspiration back. Were you bombing places?
Yeah, well, I was doing graffiti as well. And actually, before I started... Before actual gangbanging, I was in a graffiti crew,
yeah.
Which was art. And...
What does that do to you as far as an influence? As far like what do you think makes you different as an artist because you came from that? I was also into graffiti when I was growing up, and it just made me pretty good at breaking into places. And the risk factor that I got a flavor for the risk. But what does it do for an artist? Like, what do you think it had? What do you think it did for you as an artist?
It had a big impact in me because it kind of pushed me to the next level as far as my creativity went. You know, doing characters and hanging out with all these dudes that, man, I fucking do amazing work. So it's like watching them, it was an inspiration for me too as well. So I learned from them and I used that and applied it to my own techniques and my own abilities to draw and to be creative when it came to that.
So when do you figure out that you can make money off your art? I imagine there's a space there where you're like, oh, yeah. This is fun. But man, I wish... I
remember going to the swap meet and seeing guys airbrushing at the swap meet. So when I get the airbrush kit, my goal was like the biggest thing I wanted to do was work at that fucking swap meet. You know, it's like, fuck, those motherfuckers work there. I want to get that good and I want to work there. So I was still in school and I would go to high school. And yeah, that was like 10th grade already. So 10th, 11th grade. And I would buy tennis shoes and I'd paint on my tennis shoes, or I would buy a T-shirt and do a T-shirt for myself, and they'd see it. Hey, where'd you get it done? I did it myself, you know, and I started making a little money there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't enough. But I like I said earlier, I had two jobs outside of art, which was at a liquor store, acomodando the liquor and things, whatever they needed, and then at a hamburger stand. And that was it. For a very short period of time. Other than that, it was just...
The stream of art. And for people that don't know, because I grew up with it, and I remember seeing that at swap meets, we had a Kobe swap meet in San Diego we would go to, and they had these guys just drawing shit on T-shirts. So what did that involve? Like, you go there, and you're like, hey, you want this design on this T-shirt? And you have these dudes basically just...
Draw it out?
How much for a T-shirt with custom art like that?
I remember, like, for a portrait, I remember it starts $60 back then.
That's
that was pretty good money.
Good money.
$60. But a regular T-shirt with a name is like $10, $15. So, you know, and that added up. And at the time, it was very popular. At the 90s, it was very popular. So this is when all the fucking... bandas and all these groups in the 90s, ¿cómo se llamaban? There was like the Quebradita group and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and they
had,
they organized their, like, their own little groups of people. So, you know, they're going to go to this concert or whatever. And then it was like 30 members of their group. They want the same shit. So, man, we had tons of work. I had tons of work. So it was a lot of work. This is all my art life, you know, and then... behind that, I had my fucking active nightlife with the homies and gangbanging. And that's where I got introduced to the tattoos. You know, I mean,
this when you say gangbanging, I mean, this is, again, you're getting older, and shit is getting more serious on that side of your life. You go from airbrushing and kind of like figuring out this way of creating art with this insane new tool that you discovered, to going out at night, chilling with your homies, and I imagine at some point somebody says, "Hey, rayame, like can you tattoo me?"
Yeah. Right?
But it's like, I mean, an airbrush and a tattoo gun are two fucking...
Yeah, two way different things.
So how do you even start? Is it like, hey, somebody's brave enough to say, hey, and you're like...
Ugh. Yeah, let me figure it out. That's like how it happened. There was this one dude that, he was like an older cat.
Yeah.
He used to do tattoos around there, but he used to slam carga, so he was always on a sick one.
Yeah.
And he needed money to buy some carga, and he had a fucking homemade machine. So one of my homies buys it from him for $5.
Oh, he has this homemade machine.
Homemade.
That somebody, what does it look like for people? Like, I've seen some insane looking things. What does this thing look like?
It's a little motor that came from a Walkman, and it has a pen, and then it has like a bracelet that's tied up with Elo. And it's battery operated. This shit was like battery operated, or it had this one. No, this wasn't battery. This one wasn't battery operated. It had a little wire that you plug into the wall.
So it's basically this homemade machine that it's a needle that goes up and down.
Yeah, like that.
That's all it is.
Yeah, and it was plugged into the wall. But this guy had it to where it had like a resistor, so it could take the power from the outlet. And it was crazy. I mean, these motherfuckers are geniuses, but they're out there fucking around the street, you know?
Yeah.
And he told me, he goes, yeah, my homie was like, hey, why don't you fucking put my daughter's name on me? And I was like, fuck, I don't know how that shit works, man. He's like, also, Kylie, the guy he bought it from was like, explain how to do it. He tells him, no, but this is how you do it. So I told him, well, just leave it set up to where I just got to fucking go.
Where are you getting the ink? Where's the ink from?
He had ink. It was Higgins back then, so it was like fucking. It was like
no sterilization. What's going on?
No. Let me correct myself. It wasn't Higgins. It was Pelican 17. That's what he had, and it was like paper ink for pens, you know. And
this is before YouTube. There's nothing like let me look this shit up on YouTube.
Fuck no,
nothing like that. You can't call anybody like, hey, dude, hazme el paro. Like, this guy wants me to fucking put a name on. No, it's just like, let's see.
Yeah, let's just go. Like I said, that dude also explained to me how to do it. He went about his business and took off. And I was just like, fuck it. You dip the ink and you go. And I did it. And you know what's crazy? I just seen that tattoo probably like 5 years ago. And it doesn't look that fucking bad. I didn't do too bad. This is the first tattoo I ever did.
He shows up back. I was like, hey, dude, remember this shit?
I did Valerie on my homeboy's arms, his daughter's name. And it doesn't look that bad. I saw it like 5 years ago, you know?
I mean, you had a steady hand already. I mean, imagine doing art specifically with something as not forgiving. I mean, graffiti and like, you have to be sure where those lines are going. Like if you're doing graffiti or if you're doing something with an airbrush like that. So I imagine you already had like a steady hand as far as like knowing what has to be there. What about sterilizing? What are you using for sterilization? Like a lighter? Just fucking lighter on the fucking...
Yeah, at that time, I wouldn't do shit. I mean, I tattooed him, and then the other motherfuckers tattooed themselves with the same machine and stuff like that. I didn't have any tattoos. But, but after that, it was... It kind of influenced me, too. It kind of had an impact on me as well as the airbrush. So it was like, I want to learn this. And I started going to tattoo shops and start hanging out at tattoo shops and asking questions. Hey, how can I go about this? How can I go about that? I went to a studio called Wicked Tattoos in Long Beach, California. And this guy named Pine, which is a fucking amazing artist. He was a graffiti artist as well, but he was a fucking badass artist. I remember seeing him doing some tattoos and fucking work was bad, man. It was amazing. So I went in and I talked to him and said, hey, man, how can I go about, you know, machine and stuff like that? I remember him going to the back and ripping out a page of a ink skin machine, magazine or whatever. He takes off a page. He's like, buy that. And that's where I got my first kit. I ordered it, and I had it there sitting there for months. I never used it. And it, igual, one day hanging out with the homies, drinking, it's like, my brother's like, hey, motherfucker, you got a fucking machine right there. What's up? Let's get tatted up right now. And I just pulled it out and start tattooing. And it escalated into, you know, into having work. Like, I got pretty good at it, so...
Do you think it's essential for, like, if somebody's starting off in tattooing and stuff like that, which is something I've seen friends of mine that go into that. What blocks most of them, I think, is the nervousness of, you know, doing something permanent on somebody, not having, one, cool people around you say, hey, rayame, you know? Right. So do you think that's essential? Basically having the ability or the opportunity to have people around you where you have to put ink on.
Yeah, it's very essential because it gives you confianza with them. You know, you're like, okay, this is my homie. He trusts me, so I got to do the best of my abilities to make it look good, you know? And I always thought of it that way. I didn't think about fucking them up.
Yeah.
Because I was always pretty good at art, so it's like, oh, I just got to get adjusted to this. And it was different. And like I said, none of my early tattoos look pretty bad, you know? And I got to see my brother comes all the time, and I see his tattoos, and...
You think the bad ones are just shitty artists that want to be tattoo artists?
I think that a lot of the people that tattooed, they didn't, not consciously, were trying to do it right. They were just like, fuck it, let's get it done, and that's it, you know?
So you think a good tattoo artist has to be an artist first, right?
I think that it has a lot to do with it, yes. It's like, influence. But, I mean, it things have changed so much nowadays because I know guys that do a fucking amazing tattoo work, but they're not artists, so it's crazy. They can copy something, and they copy it perfect. It's really, really nice, but they're not artists, you know? And I know they're not artists because I can't tell them to draw me something, and they won't do it. You know?
Now, who's better in your mind?
I think that somebody that's complete all around is a much better artist.
A
complete artist. I'm not taking anything from those guys that do that. Yeah. You know, they're amazing artists, but they're just not...
Somebody
they're
to be
a tattooer.
Able to...
They're not a tattoo artist. You know, do you yeah. understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's an artist, but I guess he's in a different category as an artist, not a complete tattoo artist, you know?
You're tattooing your friends. Are they getting more complex as they go? Like, is it a name now? And now it's like, can you draw my hyena?
Yes. It escalates into, they see that, oh, this motherfucker did that. Okay, I want this and I want that. And
like, what are some of the most complex ones you did at the start that you right now you're like,
the Raider logo.
The Raiders logo.
My brother's got it. Yeah, I did a Raider logo on him.
And for people that, like, if you can go see it, I mean, there's a face. It's a human face. With an eye patch and a helmet on there.
Right.
And there's a lot of shit you could get wrong.
Yeah.
Like, where on his body did you put this?
On his forearm. It's very visible right here.
And again, just for people that don't know, it's like I'm learning about this too. Is there a harder places to tattoo on people that if you don't get the proportions right, it'll look skewed?
Yeah.
And are you learning this as you go?
Well, yeah. I learned that as I go. And I realized that because I did a couple tattoos at the beginning where... They didn't look very centered because I had no idea how to go about doing it. Like, for example, you don't put a tattoo on somebody's lower back where they're stretched it out, you know?
Okay, yeah.
Because you do it and you do the tattoo when they're stretched out.
Yeah.
But when they get back to normal, it's all fucking deformed. You know, it doesn't look right.
Yeah.
And it happened to me at the beginning. So as you go, you learn, you know. That guy that did, his name, that guy Pint that I'm telling you about, I'd ask him several times, you know, I'd go by a shop and ask him questions, and he was more than willing to give me answers and help me out a lot, so, but I didn't really have, like, somebody specifically telling me how to do things. I kind of just...
You had learned from experience, the hard
way. I kind of learned from experience, yeah.
What's the funniest thing you put on somebody that you remember, like, why are you allowing me to put this on you?
One of the weirdest things, I wouldn't say the funniest, but the weirdest things I did was a fucking lavadora,
a washing machine.
On a white girl, I did a washing machine, and I asked her, I said, why are you getting a washing machine? She goes, because my mom would make me wash my fucking clothes by hand for such a long time, and she told me, until I buy my fucking washing machine, you're not gonna wash clothes other than that. So she went and bought a washing machine, and that's the washing machine she had.
Dude, that's
It's crazy.
It's crazy, but I get it though.
Yeah.
As you're doing this art on people growing up and kind of figuring out your own art and stuff like that, are you noticing the change in the culture around this, the tattoo like, aspect of things? I mean, they were, for a long period of time, you were either military tattoos or criminal tattoos, you know? And there was no kind of in between. Are you noticing a change as you're kind of starting your process?
When I started noticing tattoos, yeah, I could see it more on people now, and it was becoming more popular. And I think that's one of the things that got me into heading that direction as well, because during this whole process of doing the tattoos, I was working for the movie industry already, and I got through the movie industry through art competitions in school and stuff like that. So I started working for the movie industry, and I had a lot of work. It was doing painting backgrounds for the cartoons.
Yeah, like mad paint, the background still painting and the animation that goes in the front of it, right, is different. So you were drawing
the backgrounds. That's what I would.
For what cartoons? Like for people.
For Animaniacs. For
dude, you worked on Animaniacs.
I worked on Animaniacs. I worked on.
I'm sorry, I'm like a big Animaniacs fan.
Oh, yeah.
You worked on fucking Animaniacs.
I worked on Animaniacs. There was a cartoon called, I don't know if you remember, Mario Brothers back then.
Yeah. Who was this guy? Lou Albano? Was that guy the Mario? He was like a live action Mario Brothers, and then they would go into the cartoon. Is that?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Painting the backgrounds for that. There was these videotapes that came out a long time ago on McDonald's. For the company McDonald's, yeah, where they had cartoons, like all those cartoons, I worked on all the backgrounds for them. So I had a lot of work in that, and then I was doing the tattoos on the side, but it got to the point where I had enough work tattooing as well, so I had to divide my time, and I got just caught up on tattooing, and it became so big that I would have a lot of appointments and tattooing.
Yeah.
And I got to a point where I kind of completely stopped doing the movie industry, and I was making enough money with tattoos where I just was super busy all the time.
Yeah. Is your other life still kind of going in tandem as we're doing?
Yeah. I was, my other life was there. I mean, I had already, by that time, I had already been in jail twice, you know.
And when I say your other life, like people that don't just get this, I mean, it's gang life. It's,
right.
And, it's hard to not be in that environment when that's where you grew up. These are the people that you know. You say family. That's what they are.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, hey, you're doing better for yourself. Why don't you just get out of this? Why don't you just abandon your fucking family? Is basically what it would be like, I guess.
It's easier said than done.
Yeah.
And it's like I said, it's not just because it's beneficiary for you, but I like it. I liked hanging out with my homies. I like being there. I like kicking it.
Leaving it, even with all the success around you, is just.
It was not an option. It was part of my life. You know, my daily routine was one thing, and working at these big companies, and it's crazy. Nobody knew what I did. You know, it wasn't important to anybody. It was just my work, and then tattooing my homeboys and partying with my homies and kicking it. And going on with the hyenas and all that was important to me too as well. So I treated them just the same, you know. And it was important for me to do that. And if my homies needed me for something, I was there, you know. And it was like, and it made me feel proud of what I was doing with my camaradas, you know. It just made me feel good. I liked the lifestyle, so I embraced it, you know. And then I liked my art, and I liked my job, and I liked making all that good money. And I embraced that as well, but I wasn't willing to let one go for the other. It was just like they were perfectly fine where they were at, hand by hand. So I knew how to balance them pretty well.